programming on Portsmouth Community Radio is made possible with support from our listeners and by the New Hampshire Gazette, the nation's oldest newspaper, which is happy to have company in the struggle to speak truth to power.
Programming on Portsmouth Community Radio is brought to you by our members and by Piscataqua Savings Bank, an independent community bank dedicated to you, providing personal service in Portsmouth since 1877. Now offering the convenience of e-mobile banking, a completely safe and secure way to bank. E-mobile banking. More information online at piscataqua.com.
And from the community calendar, from the City of Portsmouth Community Newsletter, the Senior Services Office at Portsmouth City Hall hosts tea and cookies on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Fridays from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, where seniors can share ideas about senior services in Portsmouth. Outside of regular office hours, appointments and personal visits can also be made by contacting Bryn Shute, the Senior Services Coordinator, and her phone number is 603-247-9531, or you can email her at bchute@cityofportsmouth.com. If you have an item of interest you would like to include in our community calendar, please visit our website at wscafm.org for guidelines and information, then email calendar@wscafm.org.
Please note that the views expressed on this program are those of the individuals who speak them and not necessarily of Portsmouth Community Radio, its Board of Trustees, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
And the weather from the Portsmouth Herald: today, mostly sunny and cold, high of 39. Tonight, some clouds, cold, going down to 22. Friday, some sun, then increasing clouds, high of 36. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a bit of rain, high of 47. Sunday, mostly cloudy and breezy, high of 38. And Monday, rain, high of 38.
And good morning, Greater Portsmouth, and welcome to Seacoast Currents with Kathy and Larry, broadcasting from the beautiful studios of Portsmouth Community Radio in the new and up-and-coming area of town, the West End, on Islington Street. Good morning, Larry.
Morning, Kathy.
So I hear you spent some time in Concord yesterday, and there were some interesting goings-on going on.
Yeah, it was. I went up for a kind of a press event with some environmental groups to basically support the EPA's guidelines on carbon emissions. And when I was up there, I was able to spend some time in the gallery of the house and observe some of the it was basically they were electing the Speaker of the House. And bottom line is, a big upset. Bill O'Brien, the notorious Bill O'Brien, everybody thought he was going to be elected Speaker, but Sean Jasper, another Republican from Hudson who served 11 terms, he ended up being elected. But we next week, with our regular guest, William Tucker, Tuck, who blogs at miscellanyblue.com, will be here. And we'll talk more in depth with him. But this is a big deal, and this is something that New Hampshire political junkies will be discussing for years.
Yeah, it's a big upset. I think this is a national story. It was an interesting coalition between Republicans and Democrats to keep O'Brien from becoming Speaker of the House. So,
So folks, next week, from the 9 to 10 hour, we'll have William Tucker here, and we'll get into this in detail. If you have any interest in New Hampshire politics, you ought to tune in.
Absolutely. I believe, Larry, you also had some thoughts that you wanted to share with us about the Eric Garner case.
Right. Well, yesterday the news came out that a grand jury in New York City decided not to bring any charges against a police officer, I don't remember his name, but who basically choked this man to death, Eric Garner. It's all on tape, and there have been protests about it, and it's just, I am truly shocked that the grand jury did nothing. It's all on tape there. The man was choked to death, and there were several police officers on top of him, and this one officer had him in a chokehold, and Eric Garner kept saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." And his offense was he was selling loose cigarettes without charging sales tax. I mean, this is it's not like he was, you know, had a gun and was shooting people. He was selling loose cigarettes, and he's dead now. And I just think that is just absolutely unacceptable and a complete outrage and miscarriage of justice. It's just, I mean, even Charles Krauthammer on Fox News said that they thought there should be an indictment.
Wow.
So, I mean, this is on videotape. This was caught on videotape.
And as far as I know, the chokehold is illegal to use.
Yes. I mean, it's. I'm sorry. It's just. It is really mind-boggling.
It's
that
offensive.
They did brought nothing.
It's horrible. You know, interestingly enough, there was, out of this case, there was one indictment against the guy with the phone who videotaped this thing happening.
Right.
He
right.
was indicted.
Right.
But not the policeman who actually killed Eric Garner.
No. It's an outrage.
And
this, along with the grand jury not bringing back any indictment against the Darren Wilson, I think his name is, the police officer that shot and killed Michael Brown
in Ferguson.
And just this recent thing where, I think it was Cleveland, a 12-year-old African-American boy was playing with a pellet gun, and the police arrived and just shot him and killed him. I think that one could look at all these cases and others, of course, and draw the conclusion that in the United States, 2014, white cops can kill black males with impunity. I mean, this is so wrong, and it's a complete outrage in every sense. And I just wanted to express my outrage.
Well, I completely agree, Larry. It's been bothering me, and I have an African American granddaughter, and I sometimes go, I don't know what to even say to her. I don't know. In fact, I was going to call my daughter-in-law today and just go, what do we do? What do we say to her? It's horrible. I just can't imagine this is actually happening in America in 2014. It's kind of a replacement for lynching.
It's
horrifying.
Yeah, no. I mean, to me, it's a problem that our society has to deal with, and not just one segment. But this is, we cannot as a society tolerate this.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I agree.
I just wanted to get that off my chest.
Well, good. Okay. Thanks. I'm glad you did.
Sure.
Okay, and we're going to go on to our guest. We've got our guest with us this morning in the studio is Maggie Fogarty from the American Friends Service Committee. And this is an organization that works with immigrants here in the United States. And good morning, Maggie.
Good morning. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, we're glad to have you back because you were here, I don't know, a number of months ago?
Yes, I think February or March, right, wasn't it?
Something like that.
Yeah.
To talk about the immigration situation. And we are having you back because of President Obama's executive order to help the situation. So I would love to just kind of turn this over to you right now, Maggie. Can you fill us in on the president's executive order and what this means for you and the American Friends Service Committee?
Sure. I'd be happy to. And I first want to characterize this particular set of actions. It's multiple actions. Some are departmental memos, some will be orders. So we refer to them as the executive actions, as a victory for a brave and organized immigrant community. People with, in this scenario, everything to lose in terms of their drawing attention to themselves as undocumented can make their worst nightmares come true, which is to be sent home to violence and terror, to be separated from their loved ones here, to be no longer able to send money home to people they love. So the bravest folks in this whole scenario have won a victory of sorts here, because after what I think it's fair to characterize as a sincere labor by President Obama and Democrats and many Republicans in the Senate to craft a comprehensive reformulation of immigration policy in the U.S. that simply ground to a halt in a government that isn't working well for people right now and isn't able to deliver on the meaningful policy reformulations that we need. So facing that failure to do action in kind of proper channels, immigrant community said, you have to do what you're able to do. You have the power of the pen and the bully pulpit. And so I think after some sincere consideration with constitutional experts and advisors, the president figured out what he could achieve for these families. And I want to characterize the good of it, because for what this means to immigrant families, I would never want to understate the value that comes with this protection that he's offered. And I also want to name its shortcomings and its flaws, because there is substantial work left to be done, work that will only get harder as we face a Republican Congress in just a few weeks.
So, Maggie, tell us exactly what this executive order does do, first of all.
Yeah, the executive actions. So on the plus side, it provides a temporary protection for somewhere between 4 and 5 million people who are currently living undocumented in the United States. And it does that in two distinct ways. It expands the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which Obama put into place about 2 years ago. It expands it by broadening the dates of eligibility. It used to be you had to be here by 2007. Now you can have been here by 2010 in mm-hmm. order to qualify if you were brought here as a child. It used to be that you had to be no older than 31 to qualify for that action. Now there's no upper age limit on how old you are, as long as you came here as a child. So within about 90 days. Oh, and the other good part of that is what was originally a 2-year protection when President Obama put it in place is now a 3-year protection. So in about 90 days, I think the processes will be ready for eligible folks who came here as children, who meet these other basic requirements, to apply for and receive a 3-year protection. It's not a legalization, but it does come with authorization to work, and that is important. And it's relief from it's partial relief from the trauma of wondering whether you're going to be detained and removed. The other piece of that is deferred action. I think it's called Deferred Action for Parental Accountability. So it extends a similar type of protection, 3-year protection, to people who are parents of U.S. citizens or of legal permanent residents. And having met a number, even here in New Hampshire, a number of immigrants who, in the course of building their life here, found a partner, got married, had children here, the prospect that they may be able to stay then with their children here is an enormous gift to them.
So if I'm correct, this doesn't really change any laws. It just extends some time limits.
Yes, and it deprioritizes certain categories of people for removal, for law enforcement action. So it's an authority presidents have been using in all sorts of ways for ages. And even specifically related to immigration, we had substantial actions of this kind under President Reagan, both President Bushes. So its impact is much larger in that it could affect up to 5 million people. But it's not altogether a different animal in terms of the tool that the president is using. So I should say, too, that folks who come in qualifying for deferred action will have to start paying taxes. Many of them already do in a variety of ways. I don't think folks consider that a hardship. They will have to pay a $465 processing fee. They will have to get a lawyer in most cases to help them with this process. And mm-hmm. we expect an overwhelmed immigration legal system. Mm-hmm. We do mm-hmm. not have enough immigration attorneys who will be ready mm-hmm. in 90 days mm-hmm. to receive what could be 250,000 inquiries or applications just in that first mm-hmm. month or two. Mm-hmm. And people will have to pass a background check. And this does get a little bit tricky. Part of the president's actions prioritize certain people for removal, and I'll talk about that in a second. If a parent of a U.S. citizen or legal permanent resident or someone who was brought here as a child goes through that background check and they find that he or she has committed a felony, an aggravated felony, or perhaps three misdemeanors, then that will make them ineligible for these protections. And in the context, Larry, of your very powerful statement at the beginning of this program, we know what happens to people of color in our society, that they are criminalized in a racist system. They are disenfranchised in all sorts of ways. So we have immigrants, I meet with them a couple of times a month in the jail, who are here only because of immigration violations in a system that gives them no permission to get a driver's license, so they get arrested for driving without a license, in a system that does not acknowledge their legal presence here or give them a meaningful avenue to achieve that, and then punishes them for working here or for trying to be a citizen, you know, live as a full-fledged resident of our community. So so people are caught in a vortex of criminality. Three misdemeanors could be three, really small incidents. So we're going to be looking closely at that background check barrier and trying to draw attention to the fact that in this context of a racial criminal justice system, that too could prevent some very unfair barriers to people's participation. So do you want to hear some more about what's problematic with this particular set of actions?
Yeah, whatever you think the listeners should know.
Great.
Yeah.
That's great. So the first challenge is that it's a temporary protection. We certainly hope that it will be renewed until Congress does the real work. It is incomplete. I think about a man I met on Monday who he's from Ecuador. He's lived here 8 years. He has two U.S. citizen children. He has he was deported once in 2013 and so needed to get back to his wife and children that a few months later he came back across the border and was picked up. And so that immigration violation, that reentry we call it, may be a barrier to his being able to stay here with his children. People, gay and lesbian, transgender people, aren't likely to be parents of U.S. citizen children or legal permanent residents. They'll be excluded. Seasonal workers who come here and then leave aren't likely to meet the residency requirements of this deferred action. And then, this is particularly heartbreaking, those brave, young, undocumented folks who sat down in front of buses carrying immigrant detainees and took dramatic civil disobedience, those undocumented youth were fighting so that their parents could stay. Yeah. And this action does not extend protection to parents of undocumented youth, only parents of citizens or legal permanent residents. So I hope this doesn't utterly demoralize their really inspirational movement. But some of the folks who were fighting the hardest, they're watching the announcement on November 20. And they see that actually their parents aren't included. Yeah. And that's been one of their driving fears. Another problematic area that we'll be paying more attention to as details get revealed that kind of got wrapped in good news, which was the elimination of the Secure Communities Program, which is problematic on so many levels. We talked about it briefly a few months ago. It really violates the principles of community policing by forcing a collaboration between federal immigration officials and local law enforcement, who then have to share data when they're arresting someone who may ultimately not be convicted of anything, but if they're scooping up somebody, then suddenly they're in an immigration database. Secure Communities required local law enforcement to hold on to people even past the time that they would otherwise be held, in time for immigration to come and pick them up. So they've gotten shot down in some communities as unconstitutional, these ICE detainers. So thankfully that program gets removed. And just as we're about to say, yay, we realize it's being replaced with something called the Priority Enforcement Program. So that will still require, it will still utilize a massive biometric database. It will still link local law enforcement, who are losing trust in the immigrant community because they see them as the local expression of immigration officials. It still requires local law enforcement to notify immigration officials if they have somebody who's been convicted of certain types of crimes. So it's going to be problematic. It's going to make life harder for those folks I talked about who didn't qualify for these protections, but who are here out of love for their families. There's a framing in the president's language and in the Department of Homeland Security's language that, again, in the context of what you're describing with Eric Garner and Michael Brown, is very problematic. It's the, we're going to go after felons, not families, criminals, not children. And so it undermines a human rights framework, looking at this as people who get caught up in a system who have every... They have every human right, and because of the consequences of our systems, may be denied their full humanity in this process. So we're going to be pushing back against that framing as well.
I'm concerned about what you said, that just by attempting to stay here, you would be breaking some immigration policy, which would then count against you when you're trying to stay here longer. And I was wondering, will these be done on a case-by-case method so that that can be taken into consideration, or is this going to be just kind of blanket, you don't qualify, you have to go?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it remains to be seen. I think there will be some general categories of response. There will be immigrants who, with an attorney, are able to show some extenuating circumstances, are able to ask for some discretion because of their U.S. citizen children or et cetera. But we won't really know until we see how this is being implemented. We've seen excellent memos on prosecutorial discretion before, and they haven't necessarily led to a more humane activity on the ground. So it's the role of immigrant rights monitors to start to keep talking about what we're seeing and is this getting enforced in a reasonable way or being overlooked? Are people able to make their cases?
Maggie, what do you say to folks who say what President Obama has done is unconstitutional and he's not allowed to make laws? And I mean, what do you say to those folks?
Yeah, so a quick Google scan of the words prosecutorial discretion will see that there's just too substantial a history, even recently, of presidents exercising this authority in fully constitutional ways. I think part of the justification for why this is so incomplete is because he walked a line and pushed where he could push and be safe from the undermining accusations of it being unconstitutional.
Right. So in other words, the measures that he took, I understand he wanted to make sure that he was on really solid legal ground.
Right.
And so that it would stand up to, you know, legal scrutiny.
Yes, that's right. And he also took actions that do not require funding. They do not require congressional appropriations.
Right, right.
So DACA, what we call this deferred action, it's funded by the $465 fee. So Congress has less of a – we're moving into this Congress that's quite hostile to this idea.
Right, yeah.
There was
right.
even a vote, I think it was yesterday, to officially say that this was an inappropriate action. But hopefully in the new Congress, they will find that they don't have the kinds of tools to thwart this particular action.
Right.
So, although I'll point out that they – if they do pass a budget and avert a government shutdown by December 11, it is likely to – only fund the Department of Homeland Security until March.
Right.
And so that extended appropriation will be the playing field for concessions and fights, negotiations.
So have we – I just want to let our listeners know that our guest this hour is Maggie Fogarty from the American Friends Service Committee, who is an expert on immigration, and we're talking about the president's recent executive action on immigration. So, Maggie, are there any other issues of substance here that you want to let our listeners know about before we get to the inevitable political implications?
Yeah. Here's – I'll flag something else that we're saddened to see, that – those who do receive this protection will be eligible for no public benefits whatsoever. One of the most persistent misperceptions in the public is that undocumented people are somehow benefiting from whatever safety net we have. They are not. There is actually language in the Affordable Care Act to exclude the previous recipients of this deferred action from receiving those benefits, as if that's in our collective interest. It makes no sense at all. And so those protections will not be these folks will be specifically excluded as well. So as we shift gears in a moment and talk about the fights ahead, fighting for access to benefits for all people who are here as being in our collective interest has to be something that people who care about social and economic justice take up, even if it takes us into talking about populations that are more marginalized here, especially, right? It's our work if especially it's folks who are not as able to fight for what they're due. So
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it's one thing that drives me crazy when people say that these illegal immigrants are getting all kinds of benefits and unemployment welfare benefits and things like this, and it's just mind-boggling that they can get away with saying that, and also that they don't pay taxes. I mean, what do you say to folks who say illegal immigrants don't pay taxes?
Yeah, so an enormous I was fresher on this particular data point prior to a meeting with Senator Ayotte a few months ago, so I won't risk saying the wrong number, but lots and lots of immigrant households using a tax ID number to pay their taxes. Undocumented immigrants pay taxes in all of the other ways that you and I pay taxes when they make purchases. They're paying into Social Security. Their employers are a benefit for which they are currently not and on the horizon will not be eligible. So they're paying into our systems that are taking care of the rest of us. So it's just not true, but it gets repeated over and over again.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know. I hear this all the time in California. And of course, California has a very hefty sales tax. They all pay that.
Right. They don't get to opt out.
No. And if they own or if they rent, they're paying property taxes. Can't opt out of that either. So
that's right. They're buying gas for their cars.
Yes. Yeah. And there's gasoline tax. Exactly.
I just want to throw in a rant here. And that is that the primarily, in my opinion, the Republicans that do this and the right wingers generally, they take their whole attitude towards immigrants is to dehumanize them and talk about illegal aliens like they're from another planet or something, rather than human beings. And so, I just think that the reality is that most immigrants that come into this country are seeking a better life. A lot of them, when I lived in the D.C. area, there were a lot of immigrants that came from El Salvador. They were fleeing the war there, okay, the war that was, you know, fueled by U.S. intervention. And, you know, they were fleeing the death squads and all that. It was just terrible. And I lived in Tacoma Park, which is in Maryland on the D.C. border, but it was pretty close to Langley Park, which is – I remember going there. This is, you know, 15 years ago maybe, and going in the shopping area in Langley Park. I felt like I was in San Salvador. I mean,
wow.
It's
lots of pupusa restaurants.
Right, and just, you know, it was heavily – I mean, that's where a lot of the Salvadoran immigrants go, but I mean, they're in general area. But the point I'm trying to make is that most immigrants are coming. They're decent people that are seeking a better life. They're in many cases, especially from Latin America, leaving situations where they're desperate economically. They're because of things like the North American Free Trade Agreement. You know, the agriculture is increasingly monopolized by the big companies, and they push the peasants off the land. And I mean, I'm trying to humanize the situation here, because when you just listen to, you know, these people, oh, well, Fox News, but people who I think are just really mean-spirited, like Tom Tancredo and Steve King, people like that. It's totally dehumanizing.
That's right.
And let's get real. I mean, most of us here can trace our roots to immigrants coming to this country.
That's right.
Of course, African Americans, you know, they're basically slaves, but the Native Americans. But the point I'm trying to make is that we need to take a more humane, enlightened, you know, attitude and not just fall into these prejudices.
I mean, that's right.
These knee-jerk prejudices. Oh, illegal aliens, like they're like trying to come in and take things over. No, they're trying to, you know, have a decent life.
They're trying to do exactly what our forefathers
right.
did by
right.
coming to America for a better
right.
life. I mean,
right.
that's what why we're here, basically.
Right. So,
and trying to do what we're trying to do today as
right.
parents and as
right.
neighbors
right.
and
right.
Yeah, I want to add one thing to your rant, too, Larry, and that's that not only are these folks being dehumanized, but these stereotypes are being perpetuated. They're getting something for free.
Right.
That they're
right.
that our
right.
taxes are
right.
paying for
right.
all kinds of benefits that they get,
right.
and it's simply not true.
Right. right. It's right. true, and that, again, it's very powerful that we're talking about this issue. In the in the same conversation that we're talking about the criminalization of black youth, mm-hmm. when you can use words like demon and thug in your grand jury testimony and it's not pushed back upon, then we can do anything to these kids
right.
with impunity.
Right.
If we use words
right.
like alien and illegal
right.
as if these
right.
aren't fathers and mothers and sons
right.
and daughters, then we can do anything. And we let our
right.
enforcement systems just do their thing.
Right.
At
right.
great cost.
Maggie, there's a letter today in the Portsmouth Herald that talked about the language we use, and someone wrote in and said that that we should be able to use the term criminal alien,
oh.
yeah, because that's what they are. I mean, what do you say? I mean,
wow, wow.
It is. It's like Larry said. It's dehumanizing people who are coming for the same reasons that are. Grandfathers and great-grandfathers.
That's right. And we need to add that analysis that,
mothers.
First of all, coming here without permission is a misdemeanor. And in the one of the Bush administrations, we made coming back in an aggravated felony. And people respond viscerally to the words aggravated felony and say, oh, well, of course, that's who we want to expel. Those are the people who are unworthy of being here. But it's really the same desperate act of finding safety, of being with the people you love, of finding an opportunity to make a life. Now we're processing it through a different part of our courts.
Right.
You know? Words
right.
have a lot of weight. It matters what we say.
Right. I have to further my rant a little bit. Basically, in many cases, U.S. foreign policy causes
right.
people to become immigrants and
That's
to
right.
come to this country. I mean, there's a whole Vietnamese community in this country now because of the war in Vietnam.
Right.
And
Cambodia.
Right. And so I'm not saying that, I mean, those people should be welcomed and be part of our society. It's just that we need to connect U.S. foreign policy, what we do, with the immigrants that come to this country. I mean, that's why there's so many Salvadorans in this country, is because we intervened in what was basically a civil war there. We, instead of allowing the Salvadoran society to go through its own democratic transformation, we stopped that by propping up a corrupt oligarchy and with its death squads. And so a lot of people out of desperation came to this country. So the point
that's
is
right.
that we need to look at this, at the whole picture, and not, you know, separate out immigration as like separate from all these other things.
That's exactly right, that these are human beings at the center. And when you mention El Salvador, it reminds me that yesterday was the anniversary of the murder of the four church women in El
wow.
Salvador. And that is dear to my heart. As a former Mary Nole missioner, my husband and
wow.
I went to Bolivia with Mary
wow.
Nole. Two of those sisters were Mary Nole sisters. And one would have thought that news would have awakened us. And I think it did awaken many who are now committed to solidarity with Central America. But we don't seem to stay awake to the implications of our foreign policy, our economic policies, the impact of the drug war. Mexico is a failed state at this point. And when they're looking for these 43 innocent young students and they find a mass grave and it's, oh, those aren't our students in that mass grave, those are somebody else. Then they find another mass grave. Oh, those aren't the students we're looking for, that's another mass grave. Tens of thousands of people disappeared just during the Peña Nieto administration, who we're supporting with policies we have been driving, a militarization of police that see local people as the enemy. We are creating conditions that force people to flee. And we, how do we help people to see those connections, you know? Because it's all happening in a context of human rights violations, and we can do this differently. We can be wonderful people in the world, but we have to first face up to what we're doing, you know, and the implications it has.
Maggie, things are going to be changing in Washington. We're going to have a completely Republican Congress, both the Senate and the House of Representatives. How is that going to impact your work?
So in a way, it doesn't change because this good fight has to keep being fought. I mean, even when we have, even with our Democratic allies, the work of human rights-oriented activists is to make sure we hold that frame of this is about human beings, exactly the points that you're making. Because even, you know, even in a bipartisan context, people want to give in to this language of, oh, we need to militarize our border, 20,000 more troops at the border, as if we want to live in a police state, et cetera. So that framing and that advocacy will stay the same. Our support for organizing in local immigrant communities will stay steady and strong, mobilizing the most affected people to tell us how we get out of this mess is still an essential component of our work. But it is very likely that all of the worst ideas related to immigration and none of the good ones will come together in policies that will pass through the House now finally and into the Senate. And we'll have to see if for the 2 years that we have a president who does care about offering legalization to people, we have to see, can we help him to be as strong as he needs to be and stand up for the need for legalization? So, and humane policy. So I think it's like looking at our state legislature. I mean, so I just, the requests for bills in our state legislature, as you probably know, the deadline is tomorrow for the newly elected legislature to put in their proposals for bills that they want. And we saw one yesterday from Representative Duarte. I think he's from Hudson. So annually has some kind of anti-immigrant bill. Sadly, he uses his own immigrant story to justify why we should be beating up on more recent arrivals. But he has a bill that would support the state using E-Verify, which is this massive database that will cause lots of problems for anybody whose last name is remotely complicated. So we'll be looking at state policies. That could get harder to fight now that we have Republican majorities on both sides here, too. So we'll just have to be more organized, more clear, braver. But the fundamental arc of the work doesn't change, except that I'll say that we continue to be more and more encouraged by the bravery of affected people. And I think that really is our hope. That is our way forward. And as strong white allies to end racism and to bring about greater justice, let's take their lead. Let's have their backs. Let's say we support the actions that they're taking. So,
I mean, it's very brave of the young immigrants to undocumented to expose themselves to this, you know, to being deported and all that in the struggle. And you know, if you look at history, it looks like that's what it takes is people, you know, putting their bodies on the line. And you know.
It's true. And if we remember those examples, then we can take some hope because these verdicts of the last few days and just the state of the world can be very disanimating, very demoralizing. And I don't think we have the luxury of staying in that defeated place.
No.
Not when people continue to be so brave and to really need allies and need support.
So, Maggie, what can we do?
All right. So I think there's a couple of things that we can do.
Good.
The way we talk about this problem, right. So not to just, you know, maybe beat a dead horse, but the way we talk about this problem matters. Lovingly calling out our family members and our friends with the language that we use, the framing that we offer, is helpful. We need to change the narrative on this. We have a program that's visiting detained immigrants at the Stratford County Jail, and we could always use more volunteers, ideally Spanish-speaking volunteers. But really, if you want to be a part of an effort that's helping immigrants to know their rights in detention, please give me a call.
How can people contact you?
Yes, so you can reach me. I'm going to give you the AFSC office number, I guess,
sure.
Is the best. 60. I was going to give my cell phone number, but I thought maybe that's naive.
I think it's best to give your office
yeah,
number.
Great, okay. So that's 603-224-2407. And that's a Concord office, but I live here in the Seacoast.
Could you repeat that number?
Yes, 603-224-2407.
Okay.
And actually, Nancy Pape of the UCC Church is our lead organizer for the New Hampshire Immigrant Visitation Program. But if you call me, okay, I will connect you to Nancy and you can
great
start doing the volunteer training. We can show up at the state legislature. If folks can sign up for AFSC's State House Watch newsletter, mm-hmm, we first started creating a weekly update of goings on at the State House during the, I was going to say the first O'Brien administration, but maybe we'll say the only
right
O'Brien administration.
Let's hope.
Right, that's right. When we realized we had to pay attention to such a breadth of issues that probably our primary constituents cared about all of them. So why put them on a housing list,
mm-hmm,
a marriage equality list, a anti-drones list? Like, let's just assume there are enough people out there like us who see these issues as interconnected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So State House Watch News comes to your inbox every Friday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How can people get that? Also,
you can go to our website, okay, which is afsc.org/NH, and actually sign up yourself. If you call me instead, I'll tell you that, or I'll take your name, but just give us your email and you'll start to get it in January when the legislators are officially back in session. We might do one before then.
AFSC.org/NH.
That's correct. So help us to be a presence at the state legislature when we are showing up to offer testimony against a bad immigration bill or perhaps for a good one. I don't know of a good bill that's coming up this coming year on immigration. We've got some bills for the minimum wage increase stuff. There's other good stuff. It's not all bad news. But if we send out an alert and you show up as a person of faith or a resident of Portsmouth who simply wants to give an affirmative message of welcome to immigrants in New Hampshire by pushing back against these policies, that means a lot. You don't look self-interested. You look like you're coming from a place of values. It helps our legislators to hear this issue, not just from paid advocates like we are or from the most affected people whose voices are extremely important. But legislators might say, well, you're self-interested. Of course, you want us to do X or Y. So the role of an ally in this is very valuable. I mean, I can't say it better than Larry has about looking at root causes that drive migration. We have to bring our analysis to push factors of migration to all sorts of related debates, whether it's drug policy or trade agreements. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a hot one coming along.
Right.
So there are so immigration is the nexus of so many issues that there's lots of ways to be supportive by bringing a human rights framework to different conversations.
Great. So. Well, if it's okay with you two, I'd like to explore some of the political partisan political implications.
Yeah, great. Sure.
Sounds
interesting.
I think this whole situation is really interesting there, and that is so. The Latino population in the United States is, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's definitely grown. It's the fastest growing minority group, I believe. And it's growing in places like Virginia, Nevada, North Carolina. It's not just the border states like Arizona or whatever.
Right.
And so just in strict partisan terms, I think that the Republicans are between a rock and a hard place because The president's actions were very, polls have shown that they're very popular with the Latino population. Yeah. And I think that I'm sure he would probably deny that there were political implications, but, well, let's be real. I think that played a role. And so going into the 2016 presidential race, the more strategic thinking Republicans realize they've got a problem, because if they continue to lose the Latino vote, that puts them in a really difficult position to win enough electoral votes to win the presidency. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, I think the more enlightened Republicans are like, we need to get something done. I mean, they even had this autopsy after the 2012 election that said they needed to pass immigration reform, even had in those heady days, so to speak, Sean Hannity, of all people, saying they needed to do this. Of course, he's backtracked since then. But the point is that the much of the Republican base is xenophobic, nativist, racist, whatever you want to say, and they view any type of immigration reform as amnesty, that, you know, for these undeserving people, and they should all be deported, whatever. And so I think the Republicans are going to, they're going to be, people like John Boehner and Mitch McConnell are going to be walking a real fine line to keep the Michelle Bachmans and Steve Kings of the world from completely tainting the Republican brand. Just in pure political terms, I think the president's actions were great for the Democratic Party. I mean, I'll be very blunt about that, you know, and I applaud him for that. I mean, in addition to the obvious substance of the issue.
Yeah. So. And in the congressional races where we have redistricting such that we didn't have a lot of Republicans feeling the direct heat from Latino constituents because those districts were redrawn to make them safer.
Right.
It didn't show up as the urgency of this and the clear division between parties didn't show up as a victory for Democrats in these last elections.
Right.
But when the party has to think more collectively to get somebody into the White House, you'd think there might be a push there, a boost there that there wasn't at the congressional race level.
Right. Well, I don't think it was a mistake that Hillary Clinton came out pretty quickly, I guess, on Twitter to support the president's actions. I mean, whoever the Democratic nominee is for president, President Obama's actions have helped that person, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I predict that in my lifetime we will see a blue Texas. And I think when that day comes, it's going to completely change politics in the United States of America.
Well, I believe that it'll eventually happen. It's not going to be an overnight process.
No.
But there is a group, I don't recall the exact name, but a serious effort being made. Jeremy Byrd, who was the field director for the 2012 Obama campaign. He was actually the guest speaker at the Portsmouth Democrats banquet in 2011. Of course, his plane got stuck in Chicago, and we had to Skype him in. But,
oh, my God.
But anyway, there is a serious effort, Democratic effort in Texas to register particularly Latino voters. And The trend is definitely in that direction. I mean, Texas is it's not going to be overnight.
It's not going to be easy.
Right.
And how's Texas on these voter registration laws? Have they? I don't follow this as closely as I should, but are they one of the states that's really restricted?
I believe so.
Yeah. So that's a factor too in terms of having to fight this on multiple.
Right.
From multiple entry points, voter rights is another one.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's another part of this whole puzzle.
Right, this whole pyramid.
Yeah.
Did either of you have any thoughts about the politics of this?
Well, I would like to see whoever the presidential Democratic presidential candidate is, nominee is in 2016, I really hope that there's someone on the ticket of Latino extraction. I think that would be really interesting. And, of course, obvious are the two Castro boys from Texas, specifically Julian, who is a congressman. I just think that would make things really interesting from a political point of view.
Right. Well, Kathy, to get in completely into the weeds.
Oh, good. Go
ahead. The Castro, what you're talking about are the two Castro, they're identical twins from San Antonio. And I want to make sure I get this right. Joaquin Castro, I believe, he is the congressman.
Okay. And Julian is the mayor of San Antonio?
He was the mayor. He is now the secretary of HUD. The secretary of Housing and Urban Development. He is the one that is being considered as a vice presidential candidate, according to the scuttlebutt that I hear.
Wow.
Yeah. Joaquin. I'm embarrassed, but he was the guest speaker at the clam bake. The Rockingham County Democratic clam bake.
Yes.
This year, very nice guy. What's interesting is they are so assimilated that they don't speak Spanish.
They don't know how to speak Spanish?
No, they never learned it.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
I'm sure they know enough to just, you know, be friendly to people, but they're not fluent in. I mean, I'm probably speak better Spanish than they do.
Were they born in the United States?
Yes. Yeah. No, they're like second or third generation, something like that. But I mean, they're that assimilated.
Yeah. Wow.
It's the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Julian Castro, I believe, that is, you know, definitely under consideration for vice president.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, interesting. Yeah. Well, you're much closer to the scuttlebutt than I.
Right.
There is a split, and probably because life isn't simple, it's probably not just a two-way split, but definitely leadership within immigrant communities frustrated that the president didn't act sooner, didn't act in time for the elections, didn't get this done in various ways. They feel like they've been used as a political football and are maybe feeling a little disenfranchised.
Right.
Then others who feel like, no, if we organize, vote, get fully engaged in the existing process as it is, that's our best avenue for change. And it's an interesting dialogue to be having among different immigrant rights organizations of which strategy will find their power. But I think as a rule, people aware they can be used for identity politics and they want to see real and lasting results for their families.
Right.
And I think what you say is really important that, you know, to encourage them to get involved and get registered to vote. And right now it's going to be tough because this gerrymandering and redistricting has made it really difficult. Mm-hmm. But the next time we redistrict will be 2020. And it's important by then to get everyone registered and voting so that we can actually have an impact on this redistricting.
Right.
So things will be a little bit more fair.
So good to have the long view. As I think Republicans have shown an ability to take the long view and then just do whatever it takes, say whatever they have to say in order to have their hands on the mechanisms like redistricting when the time comes. So we'll have some Supreme Court changes coming up. We want to make sure those are in the hands of people who have a vision for social and economic justice.
Right.
So there is a comedian, I believe he is of Indian extraction, who has this comedy routine about 2043, because that is the date, that's the year when the majority in America will be
people of color?
People
of color or non-U.S. born?
People of color.
Wow.
So I think that's going to be, I think that date somewhere lurks in the backs of people's minds. And it kind of,
I think that specter, so to speak, is what is freaking out, frankly, a lot of the Tea Party people.
It's fear, right?
Right, it's fear. They don't. that's not what they feel comfortable with. And I think that, you know, I mean, it's sad, but, you know, the country is changing, and you know, I think it's changing for the better.
Yeah.
And people need to adapt to the new situation.
Right. So part of our response may be simply trying to help people to move past that fear by mm-hmm. offering a vision that is full of promise
and
help us to imagine really what we can be.
Right. Right.
We need to do that for each other. You know, angry white people, those are our people. We have to, as mm-hmm. other mm-hmm. white allies in this, mm-hmm. we have to kind of feel responsible for mm-hmm. changing those hearts and mm-hmm. and inviting people into a different sense of what America mm-hmm. can be, mm-hmm. you know. And that's those are the folks I want to leave behind. And but I think we have a special responsibility to bring people along.
Yes, we do. I agree. Yep.
I'm reminded of a newspaper article. My husband and his family were immigrants. When my in-laws got their American citizenship back in the early 1960s, there was this wonderful article in the local Pennsylvania newspaper where they were living about them becoming American citizens. And the judge presided over this this citizenship meeting said something that just kind of resonates with me, that all these people from all over the world that come to America and choose to be Americans, they make America stronger, they make it more vital, they make it more interesting, they bring all these wonderful things, strength to our country, and that inviting people to become American citizens is good for America and good for our economy. And it's something that just has stayed in my mind. That's something that my in-laws heard when they got American citizenship back in the 60s.
That's lovely. Lovely. So that's the song we'll sing then.
Yes. That is the song we sing. Okay, well, Maggie, it's so good to have you back.
Yeah, what a pleasure. Thank you for coming, Maggie. This has been great.
Thanks for your great work, really.
Well, we're so glad that we know you and have you as a resource to come and talk about. You're wonderful, and we thank you for your work and for coming and talking.
Thank you very much.
Maggie Fogarty from the American Friends Service Committee. And we'll repeat those numbers.